Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for joining me on Forgotten Feminists. My name is Yasmin Mohammed, and I have these conversations with women who I find to be inspiring, women who I think would be very motivating for other women to find their freedom, to find their happiness. And today I have invited an incredibly lovely woman who I have known for many years. Her name is Jayla Tavakoli. Jayla is from Iran originally, but she is living in Denmark now, where she's been an activist for many years. You'll find Jayla in Ayan Hirsi-Ali's latest book, Pray, where she was interviewed. And Jayla has also been involved in making films. She's been involved in so much activism. In fact, some of that activism towards free expression has gotten her in some very difficult situations, and she'll tell us about that now. Jayla, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. You're one of my heroes. I just wanted to tell you, I think you're doing such a great job. And I'm so happy that we can work together. And thank you for having me.
My absolute pleasure. Jayla and I hung out in LA a few years back, and it was so fun. And we just absolutely loved each other's company. There's something about women who have been through hardship, who are now reclaiming their strength and reclaiming their freedom. It's really, to me, the most beautiful example of humanity. And when I find women like you, I gravitate towards you. I gravitate towards that positive energy. But let's take it back. I know you said you don't like to talk about yourself too much, but that's all you're going to do for the next hour and a half. So let's take it back to, you know, now everybody's talking about the Islamic Republic the Islamic regime in Iran. People are starting to become more familiar with it, but it's still, I think, unknown for a lot of people. They're very shocked to hear that women aren't allowed to ride bicycles. Women aren't allowed to, their voices, they're not allowed to sing. Everything is not allowed. So talk to me about being a child in Iran, growing up in Iran. And as you're answering me, I'm going to switch over and show everybody a picture of you as a child. And you can talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, I was born in Iran after the revolution in Iran. I was born in 82, and the revolution was in 79. My dad went underground because he was a communist, and his life was threatened. His friends were killed, and so he fled Iran eventually. Me and my mom and my brother, we stayed in Iran. He fled, and I was there until I was 9 years old, and this is just the last year from my stay in Iran, from my childhood in Iran. At the age of 9, you become a woman in Islam, and then you have this beautiful a party where you learn to, you know, do namaz and learn about the religion, and then really what it means is that you can get married and also have intercourse with your husband. Really, that's what event, you know, it's crazy to say, but it's what it's about. And we were just forced into it. Nobody asked us whether we wanted to do this. This was just a part of your school, what you had to go through. And I remember I was thinking I should cover my hair as good as possible, because there were teachers, you can see in the picture, actually, there are teachers telling the other girls to, you know, just a piece of hair, if it's out, you know, you have to cover it up. And it's a closed school, and it's only the parents, I think maybe only the moms are allowed, because it's a girls' school. And even so, we had to cover up and pray, and it was a crazy time growing up in Iran, because the cultural revolution, as they call it themselves, they were trying to brainwash us all. And I knew, of course, the regime was bad because my father was not living with us because he fled. So I knew there was something totally wrong with this regime. So I went along, and I remember once there came this lady with a chador to the school, and she didn't belong to the school. She came and asked everybody what their religion was, and I was so confused. I didn't know what my religion was. So I just asked a random teacher that I thought I might trust, "What is my religion? I don't know what my religion is." And she said, "Have you heard anything else? If you haven't, you're a Shia." And then I said, "Yes, I'm a Shia."
That's so, the default in Iran.
Yeah. If you're not told anything else, you're a Shia. So I just, you know, I pretended to be a Muslim, and we were just trying. I think we had the Quran from the kindergarten grade before you start school. We had Quran, I think, where we started learning Arabic words and stuff like that.
Wow. That's really interesting to me on so many different levels. First of all, you're not Muslim, but you're wearing hijab. You're learning about Quran. And then not only that, you're learning the language of the people who invaded your country and, made your religion Islam. It's very... Mm-hmm. It's interesting because in this day and age where we always talk about colonizers and erasing people's culture and erasing people's history, I know Iranians have done an amazing job of retaining their Persian culture, despite you being not even Muslim, but you're going to wear hijab, you're going to learn Quran, you're going to say that you're Muslim when they come and they ask you, because it's how you stay alive.
And I remember everybody being against, not everybody, but I mean, a lot of people are against, even at the beginning of the revolution, people, you know, from my childhood, I remember people saying, we hate the mullahs, but it was always like, people would get so scared of talk like that. And then it would be like, just in the, you know, in the bus, just somebody would say something and everybody would like agree, but just, you know, everybody were afraid of it, so they would just walk away from the conversation. But it's amazing that they haven't really they haven't been able to brainwash, you know, people as much as they should have been, because I think because of the Persian culture and the fact that we have had so much culture before Islam, and we're proud of that culture as well, and I think just the common sense, just the, you know, humanity, really, just believing in the fact that you're not a whore for taking off your hijab, right? This is what is told. You are a bad woman. You are a whore almost if you're showing your body, your hair, or anything like that. It's just been rejected culturally in Iran, and it's so nice to see that, you know, for every generation, there's just a bigger resistance against the regime in Iran. And all Iranians, we are so emotional these days because you don't understand how people can go to protest a regime, just risking their lives every time they go. And children go, right? We have had so many children die in this. You don't understand it, but at the same time, if you don't have a life, you know, especially as a woman, you're not even seen as a human being, right? You don't have the same rights legally, you know, according to Sharia law, you don't have the same rights. Your blood money is the same as a man's one testicle, you know, you're just not worth anything in Iran if you're a woman. And if you have a family that takes care of you and watches over you, of course you have a better chance of having a good life. But if you're born into a family that does not, then, you know, you really don't have a choice but to be against this regime and protest this regime. And it's just amazing to see people going, and it's very... It's where sometimes I just want them to stay at home because I want them to be safe. So I, I, it's, I have this bubble. I am glad that they're protesting, but at the same time, I'm like, you cannot buy. There are so many beautiful young children and young people who are dying, and older people as well. And I don't want anybody to die, but at the same time, you know, they have agency, as Masih Ali Nejad says. You know, you have to understand that this is their life. I'm not living there. I don't have the same. I have a freedom here. So maybe if I was there, I would do the same. I would risk my life. But it's just so beautiful and so scary. So it's, yeah.
Well, that's what I want to talk to you about, actually. I'm interested in, so you escaped from Iran when you were very young. You came to your father and you were able to live a free life in Europe. You know, you left this world behind a long time ago. You could have just moved forward and not looked back, but you didn't. You know, you risk your life even here in the West. Obviously, that, you know, it's all on a scale. The risks are not the same. We don't have IRGC waiting to shoot protesters in the streets. But, you know, when you were involved in activism, you're also taking a risk. What made you do that? Why did you decide that you were going to risk your life fighting for free expression and for women and all of these things?
I survived the terrorist attack in 2015, and after that, I was like, I knew there was, you know, risks involved in what I was doing, you know. But after that, I was like, do I even continue? Because normal Danes, they were like, you have said it before many times, they were discussing whether it was appropriate for us to, you know, criticize Islam, or it was provocative of us to, you know, show drawings of Islam's prophet and so on. I was like, if you don't understand this, and I'm doing all of this, and the Danes don't even understand, you know, what is happening, and they're not even ready to fight for their own freedom. Why am I risking my life, right? But at the same time, I came to the conclusion that I would either be, you know, be a little scared sometimes, or I would be depressed all the time. So that was the, you know, that was the decision. Do you want to be depressed and be very angry and bitter, or do you want to be scared, right?
Yeah.
Because it's scary. Of course it's scary that, you know, you get death threats, and I am not in hiding, but I'm like, I have my address is, you know, secret, and I have a lot of different things that I have to protect myself and my family. And this is, of course, you don't want to live like this, but at the same time, there's no choice for me. I can't accept it. I can't stay quiet. And I don't understand why people do stay quiet, right? That's what I don't understand. And I didn't flee Iran because my dad fled Iran. My mom and my brother and me, we got brought to Denmark as refugees, but as what do you call it? As
immigrants.
Yeah, as immigrants. So we were allowed to go back to Iran and visit, and I did so. And I wrote my thesis in college, in university, about Iran. So we went back, and going back, and I wrote this thesis about activists for freedom, like different kinds of freedom, women's freedom, students, activists, and workers activists. I used to be a socialist.
Well, your dad's a communist, so I kind of,
exactly.
I assumed.
I'm not a socialist anymore, but I was at the time, and their stories were so brave, and I decided I have to be their voice, because I have the freedom here in Denmark, and I can't, Iran is a big part of me, because the whole story of my life, the reason why I'm in the West is because of what happened in Iran. So I can't, you know, I have a responsibility, I think, to do something about what's going on in Iran as much as it's possible for me to do something about what is And at the same time, I saw the same, you know, it's of course not the same what's happening in the West, but just the fact that Islamists are growing in numbers, they're, people are afraid of them.
I mean, Iran wasn't like, everything is step by step. Yeah. This is the thing, you know, that it's the frog boiling. It's bit by bit.
Yeah.
You have to be careful from the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. And not just this year, when I tell people, like people who are not in the, you know, in the, who are not journalists or who are not activists, just normal people, when I tell them, they ask me, what are you doing? What do you work with? And I say, oh, I'm an author and I'm a commentator and I work with Islam. I criticize Islam. They say, oh, you have to be careful. I don't want you, you know, I don't want you dead, or I don't want you. And I'm like, you cannot accept this. You cannot just say, don't be a critic of Islam, because then you will end up dead. It's normal Danish people who say things like that. And I'm like, no, you cannot. This is not going to be our future here in the West as well. It has to stop.
So hearing you talk, I'm struck by how, you know, very obvious it is to me that if you were in Iran, you would definitely be one of these protesters that are out on the street. Because you were also, the people there are being faced with the same thing. Do you want to be depressed and angry and demoralized and dehumanized for the rest of your life? Yeah. Or do you want to, you know, push past your fear and maybe things can be better for you or for your people, for your country, for your children? Take that risk, you know? And I really felt what you said, you know, in my heart when you talked about just being compelled to do this, feeling like it's your responsibility, like we have to talk. When you're surrounded by people who say things to you, like these Danish people are saying to you, like, don't talk, you're going to get yourself killed, just stay quiet. You know, we know where that leads. We know what happens when everybody in the society is too scared to open their mouth, and everybody in the society just bends over and capitulates and, you know, and panders. They're just going to walk all over you. We saw it happen. Obviously, we're seeing it happen in Iran. We've seen it happen in Egypt. We've seen it happen, you know, in Syria, in Lebanon, in, you know, all over the world, all the time. We're watching this happen. It's happening right now in Indonesia. It's happening in Malaysia. People get so scared, and that fear controls them, and it allows them to accept their own subjugation. And it you know, it's really funny. In Egypt, the president in like the 50s, Nasser, has a video where he was talking about how the Muslim Brotherhood, who are Islamists, just like your Islamic regime in Iran, how they were trying to encourage him to get all the women in Egypt to wear hijab. And he starts laughing. And all the men in the parliament start laughing. What a joke. Imagine trying to tell our wives and our daughters what to wear. And, you know, fast forward to today and see the state that Egypt is in, right? It's people don't realize, people don't understand. Like, you see the pictures all the time, Iran before the Islamic regime and Iran now. You know, we can see how quickly, even how drastically. And even that's Afghanistan, fear.
Libya,
yes, Afghanistan, everywhere. Exactly. Yeah. Shocking to believe that the Afghanistan used to be like that. But fear, when you have guns and bullets and you threaten people and you threaten their children, then they will do what needs to be done. Yeah. And that same kind of fear is happening here in the West, not just with the terrorist attacks, but with the word Islamophobia, bigot, xenophobe, racist. That's fear that forces people to be quiet and to not criticize. So tell me about
either they're afraid of violence, and or they're afraid of being called racist or Islamophobes, right? And it's not going to help anyone. It's going to get more, you know, the Islamists in number are rising, and even if the only hope I see these years is people like you and people like, you know, other ex-Muslims coming forward and telling their stories and saying, no, hijab is not, you know, it's not, it cannot be a feminist symbol. It cannot be a freeing symbol. It's discriminatory towards women. It's nothing we can use in this day and age to say, oh, you're free, you chose your hijab, then you're a free woman. No, you chose to use a discriminatory veil again, you know, to say, I'm a woman, therefore I should be covered. That's not feminism. It's the opposite. And if we didn't have people like you, you know, I would be so depressed. I wouldn't even know what to do or where to go.
Well, honestly, the women in Iran, they are the ones that are sending that message to the world in a way that they can't ignore. They are so loud. They are so clear. They are so pure in their message. Taking this hijab, burning it in the streets in front of the IRGC, like it just, it makes, like you said, you're filled with simultaneously, you're filled with so much pride and also you're filled with so much fear, just terrified for these women. There's women that are, the videos of them are still being shared today. You know, like the woman who was tying her hair up and she tightened it. People don't realize that she was killed. You know, she was shot, what was 6 or 8 times. Like the brutality of these people is just inconceivable. It's too, and children in a high school, young girls, same thing. They just recently were terrorizing young girls as well who were trying to protest and killing them. Like it's, and despite all of this, you know, these women are coming forward very, very loud, very, very clear. To nobody can ignore them anymore. The international, you know, media, politicians, they have to finally pay attention.
Even in Denmark, because the social democracy in Denmark, I think they're thinking about making it illegal for small girls to wear hijab in school in Denmark. And they're not even you know, courageous enough to say that's what we want. They're, you know, discussing it a little, but I know they're for it, but they're again, you know, they're afraid of being called racist, so they're not saying it. And now there's elections in Denmark, and the prime minister, before she, you know, said now we are going to begin the election process, she said the women in Iran, they're burning their hijab in the streets, and here in Denmark, we're not even, you know, really ready to talk about the hijab on little girls. And I was like, oh, she's using the women in Iran to, you know, to start this discussion about girls, small girls in schools, you know, in elementary school, wearing the hijab. And I'm like, we live in this freedom. Why aren't we, you know, why do you have to use the Iranian women to, you know, it's just, it's weird. We should be able to say, no, we're against this. It's, we don't want this for children in Denmark. It's not okay to sexualize small children and say, oh, you have to wear a hijab because you were born with a vagina instead of, you know.
Exactly.
And you know, we it's amazing to me that we are not even ready to discuss whether, and as you have always also, you know, discussed before, that in campaigns in you know, in both the political system but also, you know, municipalities, the state, they use hijabis all the time in their, you know, campaigns and commercials everywhere. And it's like, why should we be you know, they want me to be included, you know, feel included in the society, but I don't feel included when you use a hijabi, you know. And at the same time, we have so many young Muslim women and children even coming to their schools and social workers and saying, I need help because I'm being forced to this, I can't do this, I can't go there, I can't even, you know, participate in my school, you know, the trips that we go on, I cannot go. I cannot participate in swimming. I cannot change in front of everybody else after gym class. I cannot have a boyfriend. I cannot go to parties. All of this is a big problem in Denmark, as it is in many other Western countries with Muslim, you know, especially women and girls. And at the same time, we're not ready to say, oh, we're fighting with these women and children, not with the mullahs and the hijabis. They're not going to represent us. And the ones we want to help and, you know, support being free. So it's just sometimes it's very, very, very hard
yes.
to continue. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And I feel every single word that you said. And it reminds me of how when I was in school in Canada, you have to do physical education, sex ed, you know, all sorts of courses in order to graduate. But all they needed is my mother to walk in with a hijab into the school and say, nope, my daughter is not going to take these courses. And they're like, okay, yes, ma'am. No problem.
Yeah.
And they just capitulate. You know, the answer should be no. This is the rule for all Canadian children. Your daughter is a Canadian child. This is the way it is. And I would have appreciated that because I wanted to go to these classes. And you were talking about the field trips and the just, you know, all of the fun things, music class,
exactly.
All of these things were taken away from me and my country didn't stand up for me. And then, of course, you know, in my book, I detail it even more so how they didn't even stand up for me when I was complaining to them about the abuse. But they will just turn a blind eye. If it's Muslims, if it has something to do with Islam, then they just immediately bow down.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly frustrating. Tell me about your book, Public Secrets of Islam. Is it, I know it's not available in English, unfortunately, so I couldn't read it yet. I have to brush up on my Danish. But give us an idea of what it's about.
Yeah, I wrote the book after I survived the terrorist attack, and I was like, if I have
can
to
you tell us about
book.
That actually yeah. tell us about the terrorist attack first.
I was a socialist, and then when I because of Islam and the integration debate and, you know, and Iran and what I, you know, what I knew about Islam and what I knew about Iran and the integration stuff. So my party became more and more hostile towards my comments in the press. And they actually also said at one time, I should apologize to Muslims. And I was like,
wow.
Yeah, actually, I went to an SMS meeting. There was this person who was getting millions and millions of kroners to do integration work in Copenhagen. I at that time I was elected for the municipality for the leftist party I was a part of in the system. It's the most leftist party in Denmark. I just went to this conference that he had held, you know, and he was getting money from the municipality, and at the same time he was kind of working for an Islamist organization, and kind of, you know, he was using the municipality, the
diversity, inclusion, multiculturalism, when in reality it's terrorism, Islamism, violence. Yeah. Misogyny.
You probably know Khalid Abu Yasin from you probably he's a very crazy Salafi Islamist from the US, and he's like he has talked about Osama as being his brother, and you know, like he's very controversial.
I think I know which guy you're talking about. Yes,
he's Afro-American, I think. He was invited to Copenhagen by this Islamist who got money from the municipality. So I was like, why are we giving money to this person who is inviting this psycho to Copenhagen? And I went to the conference and I sat beside my husband, and they said, no, you have to sit with your sisters. You cannot sit with the men. So I was like, no, I'm not moving. And I was a member of the municipality, and I was invited as such, right, by the person who was held, having this conference. And then people, these Salafis came and threatened me, and then we had to walk out and call the police. The police wouldn't do anything about the fact that, they had, discriminatory laws inside of the meeting, which is not allowed in Denmark. They said, we have to just take you away from here. So the police car just drove us away from the meeting. And I went to the press, and the next week, my party wanted me to apologize to Muslims because I had.
How dare you not subjugate yourself? Yeah. How dare you not engage in gender apartheid? Don't you know your place, woman? Get in the back.
Yeah. It wasn't the back. It was like parallel to the men, but still, it was
separate. Still, yeah, it's the separate. Segregation. Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm not sitting beside people I don't know. I want to sit beside my husband. And at my other side, there was this boy. He wasn't even a man. But we just got so many threats. And it was in a place in Copenhagen that is very, there are a lot of immigrants and a lot of Muslims there. The next day I was giving an interview to the press, and the cameraman told me, if somebody is going to attack me from behind, can you just give me a sign or something, say something? And I was like, what? He said, yeah, we are not safe in this, neighborhood. So if somebody is going to attack, I was like, what is happening? And nobody was talking about it, not even the cameraman. So people are, the fear is so real. And within Iranians also, even in Denmark, the fear is so real also, because they of course come and demonstrate, but they're afraid, in normal circumstances, they don't really like what I'm writing on Facebook or other people are writing. Critical of the regime or of Islam, especially Islam, is still a very controversial within the Iranians, because they're saying, oh, this is not against Islam. Oh, really? They're burning their hijab. They're saying, we don't want your Islamic Republic. We don't want you mullahs there. It's not about Islam, not at all. They go on TV saying these things, and I'm like, what are you doing? You have all the freedoms in the West. Say what this is actually about, and if you don't know what it's about, you shouldn't go on TV trying to be their voice, because of course this is about Islam. They have been oppressed 43 years with Islam, Islamic laws, with Sharia laws. The men who touch women, the policemen who touch women, they're not allowed to touch women. The reason why they're allowed is because it's jihad. They're hitting the women. It's a part of the jihad against these women. That is why their religion suddenly allows them to touch women. It's because they're hitting them, So everything in Iran is, they have arguments for everything from Islamic theology. And this is what my book is about, is saying, Islamic theology mainstream Islam, it doesn't matter if it's Sunni or Shia and other, the schools within those two main schools of thought in Islam, it's literal Islam. It's if you say the Quran is God's word, then you have a lot of problems, because then, you're legitimizing children being married, you're legitimizing having slaves, sex slaves, you're legitimizing jihad. And unfortunately, even, reformers within Islam are being, killed and oppressed, and even in the West. I think it's time to talk about this theology and not be afraid of, because we have to have Muslims. A lot of Muslims in the West, they don't know about the theology, and they don't want to know anything about the theology, because it's so bad that they don't want to know, because if they know, then they have to, leave Islam or do something about it. And they don't have the energy to do so. Mm-hmm. So they don't, They just don't want to know. That's why most of the time they say, you have to talk to my mom about this. I can't tell you what I think about this. I don't want to have an opinion about this. And even some of the imams in Denmark, we have this Danish converted imam. He says, I don't like stoning personally. I don't like stoning personally. The fact that you have, it's a punishment within Islam, but it's a package deal in Islam, mm-hmm. and I can't really say I'm not for it. But personally, I don't like it. But this personally has to become theology if Islam has, you know, in the future has to have a place in the West, at least. This personally has to become theology. It cannot just be, oh, I personally don't like it, but it's just a part of the theology anyways. That's what the book is about, trying to explain this with examples from Iran and also Sunni Islam and...
That sounds like a really fascinating book, and I hope to get my hands on an English translation.
I will obviously work on that.
And it would reach a greater audience, which I think it really does need to be read, and it's going to resonate with a lot of people. I mean, as you're talking here, like, my neck is just, it can't stop nodding. I'm just like, every single word that you're saying. And I remember saying that and feeling that myself when I was a Muslim, like, yeah, I don't like that the Prophet married a 6-year-old. Yeah, you know, I don't like female genital mutilation. Yeah, I don't like wearing the hijab. I don't like niqab. I don't like stoning. I don't like cutting off people's limbs when they steal. I don't like this. But do you think you have an option? There's no option. My mom threatened to kill me when I just took off the hijab, because I said, this is the one thing, it's my body. I can control this, you know, and I don't want to just, this is the one part that I don't want to be engaged in. I don't want to partake in, you know, I'm still a Muslim, but I just don't want to wear a hijab anymore. And that was enough for me to be threatened with death, because it, like this imam said, it's a package deal. It's black or white. You take it or leave it. You follow everything, or you are a non-believer, and therefore you should be killed. You know, and it's there's no gray area, there's no middle ground, there's no room for discussion, there's no room for growth or discourse. Now, there's a lot of, like you mentioned, Muslim reformers these days that are trying their best to do great work with bringing their religion to this century, you know. But you're always going to be up against the scripture, you know, like women in Egypt when they were trying to make domestic violence criminalized. Well, how are you going to criminalize something if Quran chapter 4, verse 34 instructs men to beat their wives? Yeah. If Allah already sanctioned it, instructed them, in fact, how is a human going to be able after that to override the laws of Allah? You know, they have a big, big job ahead of them. All the power to them. Obviously, I support anybody who's trying to progress their culture or their religion. But what a mess, you know, there's so much in that religion.
People ask me, isn't it maybe, you know, unrealistic for Islam to be reformed? Maybe it is. I don't know. But if you want to reform it, you have to have a theological alternative. You know, you cannot just say that you're a modern Muslim and I just want to be a modern Muslim, and because there are a lot of modern Muslims who are secular, who are not, you know, who don't wear hijab, who live normal lives, who drink alcohol or don't, or, you know, there are many versions of a Muslim. But Islam is still mainstream. Islam is still literal Islam. It's still stoning, cutting off hands and feet, and executing homosexuals, executing non-believers, you know, infidels, you know, ex-Muslims, anybody who is against or criticizing Islam, who doesn't want to, you know, convert or, you know, live by Sharia laws. So you have to have an alternative as a reformist. And this is, of course, hard to do because it's the same. You will have the same criticism. Even if you as a Muslim don't believe in one verse of the Quran, you're a non-believer. So, mm-hmm. you know, according to the mainstream Islamists, mm-hmm. you know, according to Islamists, if you don't believe in one verse of the Quran, or even if you have doubt in one verse, you're a non-believer. So yep. it's so hard to become infidels, they become non-believers, they become ex-Muslims. Even if they're Muslims and they just want to reform Islam, they get the same death threats as you and me, right?
Exactly.
So even in the West. So that's why if you're not really, you know, if you're not ready to risk your life for a reformist Islam, then it's not going to happen. And I think it's hard. For instance, Majid Nawaz has for many years, you know, talked about reformist Islam, but I haven't really. What I need to see is an alternative theologically, and this is, of course, some have presented, and there are also within Iranians there are like some Sufi groups who are, you know, reformist, but it's not really clear the theology behind it, or we don't know. Because it's, you know, they don't want to risk their lives. They just
exactly.
want to exist.
It's scary business. They're taking their life in their yeah. hands to try and
yeah.
give a new theology. Yeah. Like
whoever
tries to do that knows that they're risking their life. Yeah. But we kind of got off a topic a little bit, and you didn't tell us about the terrorist attack.
Yeah, the terrorist attack was because it's true. it's because after I left the leftist party and I became an independent in the municipality of Copenhagen, the three last years I was an independent. And then in those years, we started a committee for Lars Vilks, who just died last year in an accident. In a car accident in Sweden. He was a Swedish artist who, in solidarity with the Danish cartoonist who got death threats, he draw Muhammad as a dog, a roundabout dog, because there's something with roundabouts in Sweden. They always have this thing, you know, this art in the roundabout. So he drew Muhammad as a roundabout dog, and he was, of course, the same as the Danish cartoonist. He was threatened, and he lived with security guards, you know, for the rest of his life. And when we went to the funeral, even it was like, you know, just his funeral was this
security
big security event. It was, of course, only for people who were invited, and it's just so horrific. But we had many debates in Denmark with him, and it's also because in Sweden people were so politically correct, so he was like, he didn't have anyone supporting him, so we wanted to support him, you know, have a committee for him in Denmark. So we had a lot of meetings, and you know, people came and discussed with him. Also, Muslims came and discussed with him. And he would say, of course, I have also, you know, I don't mind drawing Jesus as something. Or there were a lot of, you know, examples of criticism of religion through cartoons and art criticizing religion, or even ridiculing religion, Jesus in a glass of piss. And, you know, a lot of things like that. To just to show that he's not a racist. This is just criticism.
Anti-religion. He just doesn't like religion. Yeah. Yeah.
And he's an artist. His job is to be provocative, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one of these events, it was just after the Charlie Hebdo event, and we called the police, and I said, it was just a month after the Charlie Hebdo terrorist attack in France. And the last time we had a meeting in this committee, we had given Charlie Hebdo a prize for their solidarity with the Danish cartoonists. So I was like, we have to have so much more security than we're used to. And the Danish police said, no, we're just going to come as we usually come. And they were, of course, police and stuff like that, but they weren't prepared at all. And even long story short, a terrorist came and shut up the place, and a person was killed who went out to try and stop him, and just a brave man from who had attended. He was actually a filmmaker. He just thought he could go out and even trying to stop him physically or talk to him. I don't know what happened outside, but he tried physically also to stop him, and he got shot and he was killed. The terrorist got away, and then later that night he killed a Jewish person at the synagogue in Copenhagen. So he killed two. And then after the attack in the synagogue, he was found by the police, and he shot at the police, and he was shot and killed. But yeah, and the police was not, I mean, I started just running out of the building as soon as I heard the shots being fired, because I was like, I saw the police, they had small guns, and this was, you know, automatic rifle or something like that, a big gun, right? You could hear, so I was like, you're not prepared. And he actually, the police report says that he actually came inside of the lobby of the place, because they found bullets there from his gun. And only one Danish police officer shot back, others didn't. And in the report, it says that if a terrorist comes, you should try to not provoke him, try to speak to him, try to, you know, calm him down or something like that.
A guy comes in with an AK-47 and just like give him marshmallows and, you know, maybe a cup of coffee. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. And one Danish police and one Swedish police shot back at him. All the others didn't. And I think they're more ready to handle something like that today. The police are probably, but it's just so. I just don't feel safe, right? Because we had also this demonstration against when Salman Rushdie was attacked. We had this demonstration in front of the Iranian mosque that is bought and paid by the Iranian regime in Copenhagen. We had this demonstration against the mosque, and we were so afraid, all of us. It was a small demonstration because people were not, you know, they didn't dare to come. And we were all so afraid being there, and the police didn't come close to us. They just had a distance of maybe 200 meters. I don't know in feet.
I'm Canadian, but it works for me. Yeah.
Yeah. So when we were done, and also, you know, Fleming Rose, who is you know him, he's also threatened. He was he attended our demonstration and gave a beautiful speech, and he was also there. And like, and when we were going back home, the police said, why did you insist that we should come here? You were fine here. I'm like, are you kidding me? Are you crazy? There are people from the mosque standing there, you know, just trying to be intimidating us, taking picture of us, coming close and driving by cars, you know, with cars. It was so scary to be there. Even the Danes, they were like, my colleagues were afraid of me coming here. My family was afraid for me. We were all kind of afraid, and we knew that they were probably not going to do anything, but it's still scary. And, you know,
well, the fact that the police were there obviously was a deterrent. So, you know, luckily nothing happened because you were there.
Yeah.
So it makes it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But yeah, sometimes I just don't know if the police have understood.
If they're even on our side. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's a good question. I mean, that's the same question we ask each other when so many of us get death threats. Some of them are very credible death threats, and we forward them on to our police, and they're like, oh, that's too bad. They don't even open an investigation.
Yeah.
All right.
I know, it's the same in Denmark. And I don't even understand, because I know that other politicians, when I was a politician, I got death threats also. But being from Islamists, they didn't really take it, seriously. But I knew other politicians who had just weird stalkers, like just weird people following them or just saying something. And the police would go, talk to the stalker and threaten them with legal action and so on. I was like, what? Why is it never happening? Even there was this person from the same mosque, Islamic regime mosque here in the Iranian mosque in Denmark. We filmed him threatening us and even trying to hit us, and also hit physically one of the protesters against the mosque many years ago. And I was member of the municipality in Copenhagen at that point. We sent it to the police, and the police said it's just internal, something, it's like within your own. I was like, what are you talking about? This is political harassment and violence. What are you talking about? They didn't really understand. They thought,
they understood.
It's just two clans within Islam or something. Like, I don't know.
That's so sad. Yeah. Just kill each other off. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I've never heard anything like that's probably the most depressing thing I've ever heard, because, a lot of my criticism is of the West and of their failure to respond in any meaningful way. And so I've heard a lot of horror stories, but that's a new one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's,
so
it's
I've
a little bit. I'm depressing you.
Yeah. that's our lives, though, right? Like, it's just this constant continuation of feeling so defeated, feeling so demoralized, feeling so depressed, and then just finding the energy again and again and again to pull yourself up and to keep going, even though, you're fighting such a huge battle from so many different directions.
Yeah.
But
exactly.
Obviously things like what's happening in Iran today are one of the motivating factors. Like, it makes you feel energized to keep fighting. My organization, Free Hearts, Free Minds, which helps ex-Muslims living in Muslim majority countries, that gives me a lot of energy, gives me a lot of pride. In fact, we have here one of my therapists, Jessica, has joined us in the audience. And one of our past clients, who I won't point out, is here as well. So it's like with this community that we're building. And it just makes you feel like you're planting seeds, you may not be able to eat the fruit of these trees that grow, but you're involved in, making the world a better place one step at a time. Yeah.
You energize me. I mean, if I'm down, I just go on Twitter and watch your tweets. I just love you on Twitter.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And I tell a lot of Danes who say they're afraid of, just saying what's on their mind, and also afraid of physical violence or threats, I say, the more you're afraid, the more, the bigger bullies they're going to be. I mean,
absolutely.
This is, just look at the
human nature.
But also the small time where Islamists were oppressed, like they were killed, jailed, that's the only time in history they were afraid or they, I'm not saying they should be oppressed or killed or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. But the more afraid we are, they smell the fear. I mean, they know when you're afraid, and then they're the bigger the bully they are, Mm-hmm. When Khomeini came to Iran, he didn't even think he would go through with an Islam, you know, Islamizing Iran. But, you know, he saw that he could do it, and he could, you know, he could threaten people, he could kill people, and he did, and he got to power, and we've been, you know, under that regime for 43 years. So if people had stood up to him even then, maybe we wouldn't have gone through all of this for 40 years. So people have to understand that they have a lot of power, and they have, you know, we shouldn't be afraid. We should know that we have a lot of power, and we have to stand up against any totalitarian regime or system. And Islam, mainstream Islam, not reformers, but mainstream Islam is a totalitarian ideology. Sharia law is, you know, it's ideology. And that's why I don't use the term Islamism, because I think it's a weird term, because Islamism is really just mainstream Islamic theology. And it's or political Islam. Islam is political for most of the time. Political, of course, there are reformers, and we should point that out always.
But those are the people, that's not the religion. Yeah, like I'll say Islamists, but I won't say Islamism, because there's no such religion, it doesn't exist. Exactly. There's no such thing as Islamism. Islamism doesn't have a book, it doesn't have a prophet, it's not a thing. Islam is the thing, that's the thing that we're referring to here.
Exactly. I have the same in the book also, try to say, no, there's nothing. Islamism is—it's just use or political Islam. It's nice to say. I mean, of course, I respect all Muslims. They have the same rights as me here in the West, and of course, there's no discussing that. But the religion, we have to talk about. We have to criticize, and I want Muslims to, you know, that's what we want, right? This is a Muslim thing. We want Muslims to go to, you know, to, you know, you have to be a part of this debate. You cannot just, if you're calling yourself a Muslim, please understand what your religion is. And if it's not what you want the religion to be, either leave or change it. That's, you know, that's what you have to do if you're a Democrat, or if you're, you know, a normal human being with dignity, and you want to live a free life as secular democratic democratic country. For the Muslims in the West, you have to either leave your religion or reform it. And there is no way around it.
And it would be nice if they would be able to do either of those things without having the support of people who are supposedly progressive-minded, liberal-minded, open-minded people who supposedly believe in things like feminism and democracy and liberty. It's really difficult to do our job, or to try and progress our communities, our cultures, our religions, without these people standing in our way. Like, I expect the Islamists, I expect the extremists, I expect the fundamentalists. I know that they're going to be, you know, regurgitating the whatever it is that the narrative that they have been fed. I know all about that indoctrination, because I was indoctrinated. I already know what's going to come out of their mouth. I've heard it a million times before, because I've said it a million times before. That's expected, but it's really unexpected and harsh betrayal that we also have to fight the other side as well.
With Iranians, some of them, they say, oh, I'm not a Muslim myself, but you shouldn't say this is Islam.
But
how can I even start this discussion with you? You're not even ready. Do you know anything about Islam? Where should we start this discussion, right? You're not even a Muslim.
I'm not a Nazi, but let's not talk about it. I'm not a communist, but I don't want to talk about it. Don't say anything bad about them.
It's crazy.
Yeah, we should. It's like every ideology is open to criticism and discussion, and people can say, I agree, I disagree. except for Islam. That's the one where it's like, oh no, let's not talk about this. I don't want to do that. No.
Yeah.
Except for us. That's all we do.
Yeah. We have Islam on the brain.
Yes. Somebody in the chat was calling us the Haram Club. So that's awesome. We should all be taking shots. That was you, Sahara. I should have known. Sahara, of course. No to Momo. That's her slogan. No, no to Momo. So everybody who is here today probably has comments for you, questions, discussion points. So if you're here, if you want to say something to Jayla, then please just unmute yourself. Or if somebody else is talking, then just click on the little one of the icons on the bottom there with like raising your hand or something like that. And then I'll know to call on you. I'm just scrolling through the comments here. The last one that I can see is from Jasmine, where she's saying, I wish more Muslim and hijabi women would speak up in the West. What do you say to that, Jayla?
I mean, it's very difficult to have even a conversation with hijabis about hijab. Why are you wearing that hijab? And they will say, oh, if they're honest, we had this discussion one time, and then this hijabi says, it's because my sexuality is a private thing. So you're saying
as opposed to the rest of you whores.
Yeah. So you're saying my sexuality is a public thing? So I'm up for grabs? What are you saying? If you're ready, but they, of course, they cannot say that because that's so outrageous. So they just say things like, oh, it's my choice, my body, my choice. And a lot of things, they buy that, right? They, oh yeah, of course, we have the right to take off clothes, and we should have the right to put on clothes.
They don't get it. They don't understand the context, that's why.
But if it was a Christian, let's say it was Jehovah's Witnesses, doing that, you would be against it. It's because it's a minority that looks different than you physically. And actually, a lot of Danes, they like the fact that Muslims are different. They're drawn to the bearded Islamists and the hijabi women because it's just so interesting.
Exotic.
It's exotic and different. It's so, they're just like, oh, I'm living in Aladdin or something, They're trying it's the same. I mean, I don't understand that. You have to have a critical point of view when I like different cultures, but I don't like the misogyny in African cultures. I don't like it in Islamic culture. I don't like it in Western culture whenever it shows its, disgusting head. So you have to be against misogyny, no matter if it's Islam or anything else. And when it comes to the fact that I had this Danish woman once said, I do agree with you, but I feel like you can't, criticizing Islam would be like criticizing somebody's mother. You don't criticize other people's relatives or family. It's like, it's none of my business. Like, it's their business.
Yeah. That's an interesting comment that I hear all the time, which I find to be like embarrassed for the person who just said that,
Yeah.
Like I'm embarrassed for you that you are such a horrible human being and that you don't even recognize the thing that you just said is so disgusting, Like imagine if I said I'm straight, so I don't care what happens to gay people, you know? Imagine if the apartheid in South Africa, if all the white people said, well, I'm white, I don't care. That attitude of like, that's none of my business. I'm not going to get involved. Yeah. It has nothing to do with me. First of all, the powerless need those with power to support them. Other powerless people can't help themselves. They need those with power to care. So if you have power and you're choosing not to care, that's pretty sad. And secondly, I lost my train of thought.
No, I think I actually, after the terrorist attack, I heard people not directly saying it to me, but people would have their relatives or friends say to them, oh, it's good that the terrorists just didn't attack normal people. That was my second point.
Normal people. It's attack these fucked up people. It doesn't matter. Because at the end of the day, when if you're that kind of person, you're not going to see the difference between Shia, Sunni, Muslim, ex-Muslim, Arab, yeah. Iranian. It doesn't matter. Yeah. All of you can just go over there and get killed with the terrorists together. But my second point was that fallacy that they think, oh, it's just going to stay in their community. It's their business over there. It's not going to affect us. No, Habibi, you leave that there. Yeah. You leave that garbage to fester. It's going to grow and it's going to spread. And eventually it comes to your backyard. And now what we have happening in Dearborn, Michigan, which is the same thing we have happen in London, England, when teachers are trying to teach inclusion and diversity in the schools, and they start, it was a story about two penguins who adopted another penguin, but then the two penguins were male. You know what I mean? The Muslims lost their mind in Dearborn, Michigan, talking about being gay is not okay. Okay. And that's the same thing that happened in London, England. The parents were trying to put up rainbows and butterflies and stickers, and you had the Muslim parents coming with eggs and tomatoes, throwing them at these parents.
So now this is
what you've created. You said, oh, it's just their community. Just let them do that to their daughters. It doesn't matter to me. It's none of my business. Now it's your business.
Yeah. A lot of people, even in the Danish political system, they say to me, you know what? We cannot really blend at this time because, you know, we don't want the problems in our schools, in our neighborhoods. We cannot, you know, get rid of the ghettos because if we do that, then you have to have them in our schools and in our neighborhoods.
There it is.
And we are not ready. So for some years, we have to just live with the fact that we have a parallel system. But I'm saying, but we've had that. And this is why we're having all these problems. Mm. And the longer time these ghettos are, you know, living a parallel life in Denmark or in any other Western country, the Islamists are the ones who get, you know, that's their audience. That's their
They control those areas.
Yeah,
in the UK, they had these vests that said Sharia police, and they would go around and stop people from drinking alcohol and even telling the women to go wear some different clothes if their skirt was too short. That's what you
mean. It's the same in Denmark. You have Sharia councils. It's not official. It's, of course, secret. But we have had, you know, documentaries proving that these exist. And it's not even illegal, really, in Denmark, because it's because it's not official. It's just something they're playing, but it's still, you know, they're telling people not to get divorced. They can't, you know, they're telling women, you cannot get divorced, you cannot have your children. You know, if you get divorced, you know, deciding for these women in these communities, and there's no legislation to go after these moms, not yet anyway, because it's just something they're playing. At one point, a Danish girl was converted to Islam. She was only 15, and her Quran teacher in a private Muslim school in Denmark married her. He was 24, she was 15. The municipality, the police, everyone was involved. Nobody could do anything about it because they were just saying they were married because it wasn't real.
Islamic marriage. That's all over the Western world playing those games. But anyway, I don't know after 9/11 how they can have that attitude of thinking it's none of our business. It's just let them deal with it in their own communities. It always, it's going to always come back to them. Nirvan, I'm sorry I left you there waiting for so long.
Well, first of all, I just can't stress enough how much of awe I am in with regards to you women like Jayla. I literally stopped complaining about my life after your podcast with Sam Harris. And I'm just glad to see you live. You know, it's like God does exist. My question actually is that, is it really possible to reform Islam? Or do you think people like Majid Nawaz are just trying to square a circle here? Because it's literally the word of God and you can't really alter it. So how do you reform Islam? That was my question, honestly.
That's for you, Jayla.
It's for me. Okay, I think, for instance, if the regime in Iran falls tomorrow, I think a lot of people who are now Muslims or call themselves Muslims will say, I'm an ex-Muslim. They will maybe convert to other religions as, Zarathustra.
Zoroastrianism?
Yeah. I don't know how to say them.
That's your original religion in Iran, fire. Yeah.
Some will go to that religion, some will go to Christianity, and some will become ex-Muslims, atheists. I think also some, minorities within Iran, the Muslims, the Shias, or the Sunnis, they will probably also try to reform it in some way or another, because they have such, even if they're not religious in the same way that, Islamists are religious, sometimes also within Denmark, you see a group of Muslims being married to the idea that they're Muslims, because they have an identity. It's not even a religious thing. It's just, I'm proud to be a Muslim, because sometimes even just because people are afraid of us, a lot of youngsters, young boys, they're like, we're gangster. People are afraid of us. I'm a Muslim, it's ridiculous, but it's that their masculinity is their identity. And I think we will have Islam lingering, even though, Islam is, become, even if we Muslims themselves reject Islamists as they're doing in Iran, because most of the Iranian people are Muslim still, and they're rejecting Islamists. They're rejecting, mainstream Islam, but they haven't really told us or themselves even what's the next move is, regarding religion. What are your feelings about religion? And when I meet people who come from Iran, some of them are, some of them come here and, they're married to someone, or they just came as refugees, and they're maybe praying or a little bit religious, trying to keep on to the identity of being a Muslim. And then after some years, they leave Islam. And I ask them, what happened? And they say, we're living in Iran, you can't really question Islam. You can't really even dare to. I heard you say that as well, Yasmin. Just writing your journal, what your thoughts are about this religion, or even you don't even dare to think critically about Islam. But when you leave it, or the power of Islam, the threat and the violence is gone, then you have, the freedom to think about it. And then you can't support, the religion anymore. And that is a process I think Muslims have to go through. And if someone wants to reform it because they have an identity, if they're married to the identity, or if they're, if it's very important for them, if they find peace, if they find something spiritual in Islam that they want to keep. What I ask of all the reformers is, please give us some theologic alternative, because you cannot just say, I just don't believe in the political part, because that's just going to, even if you don't, if you believe that yourself, it's going to die with you, because it's not, it's not a school of thought. It's not a religious school. It's not a mosque. It's not a website. you have to organize it for it to stay alive, because or else you know, the other the other side of Islam, the mainstream Islam, they have the theology written out in so many books, in so many mosques, in so many schools and websites, and, you know.
And in fact, the reason why children are encouraged to memorize the Quran all the time is exactly for this reason, to keep it alive. So just in case somebody burns all the books and brings down all the websites or something like that, it's like, no, this is why we need to make sure our children memorize it, to keep it secure.
Exactly.
So Nirvan, does that answer your question? Are you... It's a difficult question.
I wish we could abolish it, and not only Islam. I was born Hindu, and I am not a fan of 10 heads and 10 hands, neither of it. And it gets conflated with bigotry when you say you don't like Islam versus Muslims. You know, I mean, I mean, it's like these people have taken George Orwell way too seriously. You know,
so well said.
You know, I mean, that's all. And like I said, I'm just glad to see you guys, and I'll be a part as long as you're every time there is a podcast or a conversation like this. I'm a little mean. The next time you talk to Sam Harris, can you please let him know that he's the one who changed my life?
I can't tell you how many people have asked me to give him that message.
Because it seems
like every other day I'm texting him. Another one,
you.
Sam.
Trust me. I mean, I sent you a message and you replied, and that is something I'm going to cherish. You know, you actually wrote back to me. It was like, you know, kid in a candy store. But yeah, I won't take much of your time. You take care of yourself, sister. Lots of love. Great. And somebody else might be having a question.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Nirvan. Halima, did you have your hand up or?
Yes. Okay. Do you hear me well?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So I don't have a question. I just wanted to make a comment, if that's possible. So, you know, when you speak about education and stuff, I'm actually a teacher, and I live in France. So when I deal with students, I have a lot of students who come from North Africa, and they're Muslims basically, and their parents are Muslims, and some of them can be really extremist. So I try, for example, they ask me, oh, so you're Moroccan, because I come from Morocco, and they go like, you're Muslim, right? And I go like, no. And this surprised them like so much. They go like, how come you're Moroccan, you're supposed to be Muslim? And I'm like, no, I'm not. So I just give them this idea, but I don't go too much into detail for them to be able to see that there's, you know, some cases that exist. And that alone would maybe make them think, you know, when they go home and show. I'm sorry. So that was my point. And the other point about the hijab, me personally, I was actually forced to wear the hijab for like 8 years. And it was really hard with like the family stuff and everything. But fortunately, I was able to stand on my feet. And I actually lost a lot of family members and friends. You know, I think you're all familiar with the mess that comes with leaving Islam. And the problem is that they don't even know I actually left Islam. They only know that I removed the hijab. And that was like an enough mess for them to just go like, oh, she's out of the group. She's the Satan. So... yeah, and I would just like to say that I'm very happy that there are people who speak out about this, because I was watching a girl who's actually an activist about ex-Muslims and stuff, and she was like, you don't know, you might be helping someone who's like in a small village listening to you with the bad connection, and that changes their life. So I feel like it doesn't matter if you have like one of you or like two or whatever, the most important thing is for you to speak up. And that's pretty much it. And just one little thing, I don't know how I can reach you, Yasmin. Like, is it possible for me to speak to you later, like just for 5 minutes or something?
Yeah, absolutely. If you go to my website, yasminmuhammad.com, you can click on contact.
Yeah, because I did this and there was a problem and I couldn't like keep up with the discussion. So that's why I don't know how to...
Okay. Well, the same website that you went to sign up for this, Yeah. If you just, instead of clicking on the Forgotten Feminist tab, click on the contact tab, and then I'll get your message.
Okay.
Thank you, Halima. That was actually, I'm going to let Jayla respond, but I just want to say that I think that was really beautiful what you said. Planting seeds is incredibly important. And yeah, the speaking up and being honest and being not just pretending that you're Muslim because you don't want to deal with the backlash that or any issues that might happen with the kids or whatever, but telling them that you're not Muslim, like that takes a lot of courage. And that's great. I'm glad. Sorry, Jayla, I jumped in. I got so excited.
Yeah. No, I think it's so it was such a nice comment and I think it's a good idea when children ask. Even in my own children, I don't try to tell them what to think or about my criticism of Islam. If they ask questions, I tell them the answer of what I think is, you know, the right answer. And I ask them to think for themselves, right? Sometimes I even don't, you know, I try to, because it's the reality of what's going on, for instance, in Iran is so brutal. So I just don't want that inside of my 11-year-old. I just try to, you know, I don't want her to come to the demonstrations. I don't want her to see the videos from Iran. It's so brutal. So I keep that away from my children. And of course, when being a school teacher, you don't want to, you know, you don't want to do what the Islamists do, is to brainwash people. So of course, it's good to just answer their questions. Are you a Muslim? And you say no. And then if they have more questions, they can ask you, then they know, you know, you're maybe different, and they will, you know, have some questions for you later in the school year. I was a teacher at one time in and had a lot of Muslim, and they would ask me, are you Muslim? I would say no, and they were like, oh, like I at that time I didn't even understand, why are you afraid of that? I mean, but I mean the fear, even though I don't think they knew theologically why they should be afraid, but there was just this fear surrounding the fact that I wasn't a Muslim. They were just afraid of the fact that I wasn't a Muslim. And but that fear is so real within Muslim communities. So good for you for being honest with them and.
Yeah, absolutely. As a teacher, your job is to teach kids how to think, not what to think. So you're doing a great job, Halima. I saw a couple of hands pop up and then they went away. And I think one of them was Sahara.
Yes, I did have my hand. Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming to the club, Haram Club and the Infidels.
I wish family. This was vodka.
Jayla, thank you. Respect and love to you and power to you. And congratulations first for, you know, we're able to live and survive, you know, escape from Iran and live in kind of a free, but nowadays we are being silent, even the West, right? So respect and congratulations, and what's happening in Iran it hits close home because I came from that world. I grew up in Kenya, and I grew up culture and religion, that one way of thinking. And if you think outside the box, you were either, you know, tortured or sometimes disappear, unfortunately. So it's important for us here in the West. You know, I live in the United States. I'm grateful to be here. And many of us are fortunate to be here, even though, yes, this is scary to speak out. And, you know, especially these bullies, right? They want to bully us. They want to silence us. But we are not going to be silent, you know, no more silent. And we need to speak. And we need to call out these people who are, you know, doing horrible things to their girls or children. Especially I speak about female genital mutilation, where they mutilate little children. And that is happening also in the West, in America. And they get away with it because the Western, we have a problem. Those people who are supposed to protect the children in this country, I mean, the whole world should be protecting these small children, but especially West, you know, where children supposed to be protected, these people are getting away and they are doing behind the scene because they follow Islam. These people are Muslims, and it's just the privilege, you know. Why is it when it comes to Islam, these people, especially the mainstream media, they just go in their corner, you know, like they don't want to be called Islamophobe and racist, it, which is just ridiculous. Islam is not a race. Islam is an ideas, a set ideas, and we should not be scared, and we should be able to criticize the way we would criticize Christianity, Buddha, or any other religion. So I am just so proud of so many of you, especially what's happening in Iran. It's just, it really gives us power here. We need to speak more. More of us have to come out and say, I left Islam. And it's so garbage getting killed people because they left Islam or removed their hijab. That is a garbage. And I'm not gonna respect your ideology. And you need to get over it, because in the West, your ideology is gonna be called out and your barbaric practice is gonna be called out. And you need to get over it, and you're not going to kill people. So I think we just need to be courageous, and we just need to really be clear message. I really don't care who gets offended. I have spaces. We created a Twitter space where, so at least we can spread these, you know, awareness conversation, because so many ex-Muslims are in the closet because they're afraid to come out, even in the West. Why is it this ideology is so untouchable? This ideology that takes your humanity, your whole life, your livelihood. Yeah, and I'm just like so disappointed with the West that it just gets away with everything it wants, you know? There literally, I don't believe privilege, but there is a privilege, Muslim privilege here is going on, that if you're a Muslim and, you know, you are kind of like, you know, using the Islamophobia card and all that nonsense, you can get away with everything. You know, the anti-Semitic, you can say those things. But if it comes from us, like, you know, criticizing Islam and calling our little children being mutilated, that we are being Islamophobic, that's a BS. And just give me a break. I don't care what you call me racist, call me Islamophobe, call me Sharmuta, you know, like whatever, whore, everything you wanted. I'm not gonna be silent. I'm gonna speak out. And I think more of us have to come forward and respect it to many of you. And I get it. You have to be safe. Safety comes first. But in the West, we have obligation. It's our duty to come out and just say, like, you know what? I don't practice this religion and I don't wear the hijab and it should be okay. And people should not be killed. Sorry, I kind of ranted, but I just wanted to say thank you. And I hear you, what's happening in the West and especially the mainstream media. But I say what I do because I'm not going to be put in a box, because I ran away from that box and I'm not going to go again. So thank you, Jayla. So respect and love to you.
Thank you, Yasmin, so
everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, Sahara. I see Deborah has been trying to raise her hand. So, oh, there you are, Deb. just go ahead and unmute yourself.
Hi, sorry, I'm like typing away over here like an idiot.
It worked, I saw it.
This perfect. Is so cool, Sahara. I am on freaking fire, girl. That was awesome. And Jayla, thank you so much for sharing and being so brave. Excuse me, I've got horrible allergies, and right when I talk, of course, I'm gonna sneeze. But I have like a personal investment in this topic of hijab and Islam and I'm so sorry, and the oppressive nature of it. From my perspective, it doesn't matter what religion you are, because the oppression is, especially towards women and children, is so inherent and deeply rooted in religions. I mean, the three major religions for sure. And also, you know, I escaped a cult when I was a kid. My son is Muslim and very, very deeply into his Islamic beliefs. My daughter-in-law and granddaughter are fully covered when they go out in public. gloves. So it's, I have a vested interest in being a part of this conversation and advocating for, I'm so sorry. Advocating.
That's okay, Deb, because you're gonna come on Forgotten Feminists, and we're gonna hear it. Take your time.
I'm gonna sneeze. I'm so sorry. I like doubled up my medication too before this, but and also having been around Muslims a majority of my life, and seeing the indoctrination, seeing the fear, the terror that is inflicted into especially women and men too. I mean, we don't see very many men standing up and saying, this is bullshit. We're going to let our women have some freedom. We need more of that. We need more men to say enough is enough and quit hiding behind our skirts as we speak out, or as women such as you speak out and say, we're not going to stand this anymore. I know that sounds pretty harsh, but it needs to be said. We need all people to speak up and to say, this is wrong and this is oppressive. And for me, as an ex-Christian and being in a very oppressive religious environment most of my childhood, for me to say Christianity is bullshit, I feel that safety. But even being exposed to Islam and knowing the way that works, saying Islam is bullshit is terrifying even to me. So kudos and bravo for women who are standing up and saying no more, and especially the women in Iran who are throwing off their hijab, wearing their hijab. Oh my gosh. Anyway, I'm on a rant, but
yeah. Yeah, I think, yeah, and you know what, one thing I think is being overlooked these days is also that the Iranian young men on the streets are fighting, you know, for women's freedoms. And it's maybe the first time in history so many men are invested in risking their lives for freedom for women, right? That's how it started. Of course, it's against the regime and the totality of the regime, but it started with women's right to have you know, the right to go out the house wearing what they want to wear, and it's, I mean, the men supported this fight from the start, and I'm so proud of the men, of the Iranian men, because when the regime came to power, they wanted to, you know, the first Islamic thing they did was to, you know, demand that women should be covered. Mm-hmm. And the women went to the street. There are so many pictures of the big demonstration in Tehran where, you know, hundreds of thousands of women went to this demonstration, and there was no men there. The men didn't really support the women at that time. And my father, he said to me, you know, at that time, we really didn't even see that the women were like, you know, they were oppressed in Islam. We didn't even think about it. We didn't understand it. He said a woman came and gave us money to his former party, political party, and said, you have to do something for the women. And he said, of course I took the money, but I didn't even understand what she was talking about, because we didn't think about even the opposition, the men in the opposition, like the exile opposition, some of them, they still don't understand it, because they're used to thinking about ethnic groups who are being oppressed, or they have other, agendas, and they don't think about, because if you're not a woman, then you just don't really think about the fact that women are not even being treated as humans, and opposition, you know, it is male dominated, even in exile, right? So the women revolution in Iran is actually, it's surprising, the opposition, they really don't understand. Masih is like, she's like this hero that came from nowhere, and she's like, everybody wants her to be the leader. I mean, all of the opposition outside of Iran, they're like, we didn't even see this fight coming, and you know, now it's going to be a women's revolution against the Islamic Republic, and it's just, also, actually, I see this also in the West sometimes, that the men really don't have that big of a problem with Islamic ideas, because it's male dominated, it's very masculine, it's, you know, and in a place where masculinity is really cursed in today's world with the woke ideology and so on, some men kind of defend the, you know, ideas of Islam and say, oh, we don't want this porno culture, you know, some conservatives even. And I'm like, no, you're totally wrong. You know, Andrew Tate, you probably, you know Andrew Tate, right? Jasmine, no?
The
Andrew Tate.
This
guy, yeah. He went out and said, I like Islam. Islam is the only religion who stands up for men and rights, you know? And some Islamists.
Quite a few people on conservative Americans have said similar things.
Yeah, and they want to ban transvestites, or not transvestites, but trans people who, you know, all of the queer, you know, movement that where people dress different or act different. And it's like,
because it's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's a right-wing religious conservative traditional fundamentalist extremist ideology. It makes sense that they're going to like each other. That's not a surprise to me.
Yeah.
But it's a surprise to everybody else who thinks that Muslims are that Islam is on the left somehow, you know, that they've created that confusion. But
but it's, I mean, we have to, you know, both on the west, on the left and the right, we have problems with people, you know, making excuses for Islam instead of, you know, seeing that, oh, this is a threat to our civilization, really, because the ideas are so bad, you can't even make it up, you know?
Absolutely. So we have really gone over time today, but we had so many people here that really wanted to speak with you, Jayla. So just want to wrap it up and want to make sure that everybody who had something to say had a chance to say it. I know there's been a lot of comments, and unfortunately, I haven't been able to read them all. Yes, girl.
Can I say my login? Kind of like I say, you know, so the space I was talking, Twitter space, we have Aliyah and I, you know, for Silent Voices in Islam. And we have, you know, people coming and calling us nonsense. And, you know, and we go, no, no to Momo, no, no to Owo, no, no to Bobo, no to Toto, Toto is Truro. So all these people who wants to control, you know, people, F them all. I'm not sorry, F them all. And so it literally it's just no to these people. And when these, I'm talking about cancel culture, when they said, oh, but we don't want to talk about Islam because we don't want to offend these people. Well, let them cry. You want people like, you know, you want to defend these people mutilating their children and doing child marriage and horrible things and forcing little children to wear the hijab. You want to defend that culture? Something is wrong with you. No to all that crap. And we're going to speak. So continue speaking, guys. And thank you so much. No, no to Momo. No, no to hijab. And free from hijab forever and ever. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Love and peace. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you. Now we've got hands going up, Nirvan and Dr. Devran, but we've, oh my gosh. And Leora, come on, you guys, are we going to sit here for the rest of the day?
No, not at all. But I just wanted to say, you know, I had to really quote Hitchens here. You know, when someone says I'm offended, they say like, it's as if it's a perfect, constitutes a perfect argument, which is stupid. And I really don't understand what offense means here, you know, when you're trying to challenge an ideology. So yeah, again, to quote Hitchens, if you give Prophet Muhammad an enema, you could bury him in a matchbox.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Nirvan. Leora, did you want to ask Jayla a question?
Hi. I didn't want to ask a question. I just wanted to thank you, Jayla, so much for sharing your story.
Thank you for
all the work that you do to speak up and help those who need to be heard. And that's all I want today. And it's like, I wanted to speak about just a point when people say that all religions are oppressors and you get oppressed in all religions, but in Islam, it's deeper and it's more. So for me, who was raised a Muslim, I always look at it as Islam is a different religion than anyone else. I wasn't able to even open a bank account. I wasn't able to go to university without the permission of my father, or do anything without the permission of my father. Women until this day, they can't even sign a paper to help her child in a hospital to go through an operation. The father has to come and sign the documents for the child. I wasn't able to do anything. And until this day, it's happening. I see other Christian women say, I'm leaving the religion, and maybe they will be disowned for a year or two, and then their families will come back and speak to them. With us, we're disowned for the rest of our lives. We lose our family, we lose our community. So it's, to me, it's just not the same. And that's it. I would like to thank you again. And no to Momo, as Sahara said. Thank you.
I love that. I love that. And I just want to say, I feel like your family members, all of you, because it's just a fight that it's a minority within a minority that has, you know, we are so many across the world, but we are so few at the same time. And I just feel like you're all my family members. And also, of course, there is this big thing that we lose a lot of people, also family. I've lost family, not lost them, but, you know, who have you know, taken a distance from you, because even friends, I don't have really that many Muslim friends in my life anymore, because they're just afraid of you, even if they're not, you know, against what you're for, they're just afraid for and of you. So if you speak up against the religion, and therefore I'm just so happy, my heart is filled with love for all of you who I meet here and on social media. Thank you for speaking up, all of you.
Thank you.
Oh, that's so lovely, Jayla. And our hearts are filled with love for you, and thank you for speaking up. I really appreciate you sharing your story and, you know, engaging us all in conversation. There's still hands going up, but I'm sorry I have to go, you guys. It was supposed to be an hour and it's been two. But hopefully Jayla will be willing to come back again for a part two.
Of course.
And of course, you can follow her on Twitter as well and on Facebook. That's correct. And I think even on Instagram.
Yeah, I have. I've made a profile. I'm not using it that much.
I'll add links to your Facebook.
Instagram. Yeah.
Okay, I'll add links to your Facebook and to your Twitter to this. To this conversation, and people can follow you there and keep it going, because you're right. This is the new family. We've created this new family. We've created this new community of like-minded people, and our family isn't based on, you know, what part of the world you're born in or what religion you were assigned at birth.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. It's a family that it's a chosen family, and there's nothing better than that. So let's definitely all keep in touch. Now.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jayla,
for having me. Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure. Take care, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.